It's Wednesday, April 14th, and the simplest, most straightforward vaccine is now tangled in doubt. We start here. Barely 2 weeks after giving it the green light, the FDA tells states stop injecting people with Johnson & Johnson.
That boils down to a risk of 1 in a million.
This could affect everyone, whether you've gotten that vaccine or not. We'll tell you what you need to know. We spent 19 anniversaries with troops in Afghanistan. Well, on the 20th, could they really be out?
We may end what we're doing in that war, but it doesn't mean that conflict will end.
The new schedule for the American military in our longest war. And her son was killed by police. Now she's welcoming another mom to the sorority.
Resignation is not good enough for me. They should be terminated.
Why activists in Minnesota say resignations are still letting police off too easy. From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Brad Mielke. It's been more than 2 weeks since Johnson & Johnson received an emergency use authorization for its COVID-19 vaccine. And remember, this was a huge deal for the American vaccination effort. This vaccine was easier to store, it was cheaper to make, and it's one shot. With Pfizer and Moderna, it's a month before you can really say anyone's fully vaccinated. Well, with J&J, your town could make a dent in a weekend.
We're going to move on now to the pandemic. There's some breaking news coming in. The CDC and the FDA have released...
Well, yesterday, the CDC and the FDA made one of the most consequential warnings of this pandemic.
Tonight, the FDA is telling everyone to hold off using the Johnson & Johnson vaccine.
A recommendation to states to pause their distribution of this Johnson & Johnson vaccine while they investigate whether it could cause potentially fatal blood clots.
Every site... has been told this morning to stop giving J&J shots.
Our team here switched over with the help of Walgreens to the Pfizer vaccination.
As of this morning, all 50 states have complied. There are no Johnson & Johnson vaccines being given in the United States right now. And think about what a big deal that is, because right now, more than 700 Americans are still dying every day from COVID. The way out, we've been told, is to vaccinate people as quickly as humanly possible. So whatever is keeping us from doing that, that would have to be incredibly dangerous, right? Well, here's the thing. It's not clear at all that this vaccine is dangerous. It does not appear to be a widespread problem. It's not even clear that it definitely causes those blood clots. So, was this the right decision? And now that it's been made, what does that decision mean for you? We've got ABC's chief medical correspondent, Dr. Jennifer Ashton, with us, along with ABC's Ann Flaherty, who's been covering every angle of the vaccination effort. Dr. Ashton, can we just start with, is this vaccine safe? It's been injected into people's arms millions of times already, and what, now it's not recommended anymore?
Well, I think, Brad, here's the way people need to look at this. They need to go to the facts and realize what the numbers are. And as we heard yesterday, there have been almost 7 million J&J doses administered so far in the United States. And so far, only 6 cases of this rare clotting disorder that's also associated with low platelet count, which ironically increases bleeding. All of them have occurred in women. One death, tragically. One of the 6 cases, the woman is in the intensive care unit. So that boils down to a risk of 1 in a million or less than 1 in a million. So our public health organizations and agencies have done a pause. They've identified a possible, underscore the word possible, safety signal. When they investigate that, then they will determine whether or not there is, in fact, an increased risk that has been causally tied to the vaccine. Right now, this pause is being done out of an abundance of caution, and we saw J&J come out very quickly and say that they were going to pause the rollout in Europe as well while this issue was investigated. So I actually think, Brad, people should be reassured that this is our scientific public health medical system at work and that no corners will be cut when safety is concerned.
Yeah, and Flaherty, what went into making this decision? Because this came from the FDA and the CDC.
That's right. It was a joint decision. And what we heard from them yesterday was that this was a pattern.
The background rate of that is probably somewhere between 2 and 14 per million people. But that's in the setting of a normal platelet count.
This wasn't just about a blood clot. This was about blood clot plus low platelet counts that seemed to be spurred on by an immune response triggered by the vaccine.
Those two things can occur. It's their occurrence together that makes a pattern And that pattern is very, very similar to what was seen in Europe with another vaccine.
So they compared it to what is possibly happening with the AstraZeneca vaccine in Europe.
I was going to ask if it was related at all.
Well, they don't know. So what they told us yesterday was that, look, this warrants investigation. Imagine if we saw this pattern and we didn't say anything.
A couple of issues come up of the importance of calling this pause, because people say, what does the pause mean? It really allows both the FDA and the CDC to further investigate these cases to try and understand.
So the hope, Brad, really is two things. One, that people might give them more information. There might be patients out there who say, you know, I had a similar effect or symptom. And then the second thing is about treatment.
And when you have thromboses, the most common way to treat that is with heparin. That would be a mistake in this situation because it could be dangerous and make the situation much worse. So there's a clinically relevant reason why you want to make this known to people.
They don't know exactly what should happen when patients present with these symptoms. They do know that heparin, which is the commonly used blood thinner, could possibly make this worse. So they want to get answers on that.
But so I guess the thing I'm hung up on is, like, we see medications that can potentially cause blood clots. Like, that's not new. They exist. Birth control is one. Dr. Ashton, you've had an OBGYN practice for years. Like, if blood clots are so dangerous, you would interrupt a nationwide vaccination effort. Are we just cool with blood clots happening in some cases and not others? Like, why pause it for this?
Well, I think the reason for that, Brad, is it has to do, again, with numbers. Remember that the clinical trials were done in, let's say, 30,000, 40,000, 70,000 people. When you start vaccinating 3 to 4 million people a day, or your goal is to vaccinate 200 or 250 million people in one country, then you're going to start to see higher numbers associated with those quote-unquote rare events. But there's a saying in medicine, an increased risk of a rare event is still a rare event.
This is a really rare event. If you look at what we know so far, there have been six out of the 6.85 million doses, which is less than one in a million.
There are some infectious disease, public health, and epidemiologists who feel that they jumped the gun a little bit and they made this decision prematurely. But, you know, I have to tell you, Brad, you know, the Hippocratic Oath, people say, first, do no harm. I think it's appropriate to pause and look and collect information.
Right. Well, I guess then the concern going forward is, does this pause create harm in itself? And, I mean, yesterday there was this teleconference between a bunch of governors and White House health officials. ABC's Catherine Falders actually obtained audio of this meeting. What concerns are being raised by states now? Like, they've already got vaccine hesitancy issues. They're trying to get more people vaccinated. Like, they're trying to save lives.
That's right. There was a bit of pushback on this phone call, Brad.
Look, if I can just be frank, in the sake of time, the questions we're receiving over the last a few hours on this are significant.
Governor Sununu from New Hampshire, for example, said, you're telling me that we're going to halt these life-saving vaccines that we need so that you can investigate these symptoms that are statistically insignificant, he said.
The ability for governors to reinstill confidence after something like this is 100 times harder than putting the pause on in the first place.
You know, Governor, I understand what you're saying, but
Dr. Fauci pushed back and said, I don't think we are pulling the trigger too quickly on this. I think we're being prudent and we need to get answers.
So you're right. The faster we get out of the pause, the better.
CDC's Walensky said we're going to have answers, she hopes, in a matter of days, not weeks to months.
They got these huge, massive concerns about data. They think they can get that all in a couple days?
They are hoping so. They're going to meet with an advisory panel today and try to get to some answers on this. They know that this is bad optics for this vaccine.
With an appointment first thing this morning to get the Johnson & Johnson vaccine at the Javits Center, this morning's news left Nick Clochard with many questions.
I want to ask them if they will give me the Pfizer. Otherwise, I think I'm going to cancel. I'm not going to take any chance.
But, you know, as I mentioned before, imagine if they detected this pattern and they didn't talk to the public about this, or they didn't alert healthcare providers. Mm. Because, you know, as I mentioned, when you give that blood thinner heparin, it could be more damaging, is what Dr. Fauci said, than alternative treatments. So people need to be aware of this. They need to know to look for symptoms and they need to know how to treat this.
So what should we be looking for? Dr. Ashton, if the FDA does give the green light on Johnson & Johnson again, if you go into a vaccine center and they say, great, you're getting the J&J vaccine, should we trust that? And what should we be looking for?
Well, I think, first of all, it's important to remember that there's no such thing as zero risk when you talk about medicine and disease and even public health.
For people who've received this vaccine more than a month ago, the risk of blood clot is extremely low. We have no cases that have occurred after the window of 2 to 2 weeks.
I think what they should look for, if they are getting the J&J vaccine down the road potentially, or if they have gotten it in the last 3 weeks, headache, severe abdominal pain, severe headache, severe leg pain. You know, you should be in communication with a healthcare provider if you have one. If not, and the symptoms are severe, obviously seek medical attention in an emergency room.
And I want to also articulate that we are not seeing these events associated with the other two vaccines, those from Pfizer and Moderna.
And you should know what vaccine you've gotten. That's very, very important. That speaks to health literacy, and that is awareness, which is very powerful on the patient's part and on the healthcare provider's part.
Although I got to imagine, and the CDC has already said this, they are already seeing more phone calls than usual from people who might just have psychosomatic reactions to this. Clearly, people are going to be nervous. That's why I think it's important to hear what Walensky was saying there, that if it goes for more than a few days, that not just the day after you get the vaccine, but if you're really feeling discomfort for more than a few days, that's kind of a good threshold at which you might want to say, hey, let's get this checked out somehow. All right, Dr. Jennifer Ashton and Flaherty, great information. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Brad.
Thanks, Brad.
Next up on Start Here, September 11th is much more than a date. Well, this year, it's a deadline as well. We're back in a bit.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table. Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view. The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
This might have snuck up on you, but this September 11th will mark 20 years since the attacks that shaped an era.
The unthinkable happened today. The World Trade Center, both towers, gone.
As for who is responsible, all leads seem to point to suspected terrorist Osama bin Laden.
Well, for each of those 20 years, we have had American troops armed and fighting on the ground in Afghanistan. But yesterday, President Biden said this upcoming September 11th will mark the end of that era.
The president has been consistent in his view that there's not a military solution to Afghanistan, that we have been there for far too long.
ABC's chief global affairs correspondent Martha Raddatz is here. Martha, can you just help us understand this big decision from the White House yesterday? What is going to be happening exactly?
I think President Biden is going to take all U.S. troops out of Afghanistan, which is so extraordinary after 20 years, and a lot of men before him have tried to do the same.
He also believes we need to focus our resources on fighting the threats we face today, 20 years, almost 20 years after the war began.
It is something, of course, former President Trump wanted to do, former President Obama wanted to do, but President Biden says he will do it.
And often when we hear, hey, all the troops are coming home, except like a small fighting force, a small group of, is this, when we say zero, is this truly zero?
I think we'll have to wait and see on that one. One of the things we've seen over the years, over these 20 years, really, is there are a lot of contractors who help out U.S. military forces. I think at the very least, you will have a counterterrorism force, if not in Afghanistan. And I would say that might be unlikely, given what the president is saying he will do, that counterterrorism force will be nearby and be able to respond if they see some sort of imminent threat or any kind of threat.
Rebuilding that country as a whole nation is beyond our capacity. I argued from the very beginning that we should have a policy that was based on an anti-terrorism policy with a very small footprint.
You mentioned President Trump, President Obama, the same questions that bedeviled them. Like, you know, if you remove troops, does that give the Taliban an edge? If you remove troops, can Afghanistan's military really cope without us? Those questions haven't gone away, right? So what is President Biden's answer to those questions?
Those questions are exactly what has kept U.S. forces in Afghanistan for 20 years.
There'll be battles, but this is long term. After all, our mission is not just Osama bin Laden, the Al-Qaeda organization. Our mission is to battle terrorism.
The debate has been, wait a minute, if we pull out all the troops, then the Taliban will move back in, then they will shelter Al-Qaeda. I think people have forgotten that the reason we, the U.S., attacked and NATO allies attacked Afghanistan is because that's where Osama bin Laden was when he plotted the attacks of 9/11.
I gave Taliban leaders a series of clear and specific demands. Close terrorist training camps. Hand over leaders of the Al-Qaeda network.
And the Taliban were helping him, sheltering him.
None of these demands were met. And now the Taliban will pay a price.
They do not think that will happen again, that the Taliban will do that. It would be very risky for the Taliban to do that. But the Taliban is a threat in itself, certainly to the women of Afghanistan and to the Afghan government as well.
Here in Afghanistan, it's a combination of counterterrorism and counterinsurgency. And counterinsurgency, securing the population, helping them out with jobs, takes a lot of troops, a lot of time, and we've already been here for a decade.
I always think when I hear the phrase from any political leader, we want to end that war. It is really not up to us to end that war. We may end our participation in that war. We may end what we're doing in that war, but it doesn't mean that conflict will end.
Right. Because of that, the reaction to this does not necessarily fall along traditional party lines. You got Democrats that love this. You got Democrats that hate it. Same with Republicans. There are Republicans backing up Joe Biden. There's others saying this is absolutely the wrong move. We'll see how this actually shakes out as we approach September 11th. Martha Raddatz, thank you.
Thanks, Brad.
It's been 3 days since Minnesota police tried to arrest a 20-year-old man named Dante Wright. There was a scuffle. Wright was unarmed. A police officer claimed she tried to fire a taser at his chest. Instead, she fired a bullet.
During the curfew that went into effect at 7, we're in violation of the curfew.
This is one of the businesses that was looted overnight.
Since then, protests have grown. And so is the level of destruction from some pockets of the crowds. Yesterday, we saw authorities scrambling to contain the fallout.
That is a question that we will get back to you on.
Chief, as a parent who lost a son only a few thousand, I'm just really concerned.
But as city leaders were giving a press conference saying they're still trying to figure out a response, a woman interrupted them, saying action is not just needed, it's overdue.
So we don't need him at the park. We need him to be the park. We need him to have empathy, sympathy.
That woman's name is Kimberly Handy Jones. She became a police reform advocate when her own son was killed by police gunfire in St. Paul, Minnesota, Minneapolis's Twin City, 4 years ago. She joins us right now. Ms. Handy Jones, you were in Chicago when you heard about the shooting of Dante Wright. You came back to Minnesota and you interrupted this big presser. Why?
I had to. When the acting chief, when they asked him, you know, what would he do different?
You know, it's very chaotic right now. You know, we just informed less than a half hour ago or an hour ago about the change in status. There's just a lot of chaos going on right now. We're just trying to wrap our heads around the situation and try and create some calm.
You know, wrap his brains around it. Like, if that was just really inhumane to me, and it spoke to my core.
He can't wrap his head around that. What went on with Dante Wright? I wrap my head around it every day.
Because if you were to ask me that, when Sandra Bland and Eric Gardner, Alton Sterling and Michael Brown were being gunned down, I mean, surely I can speak to that.
I'm going to need you to wrap your mind around it. I'm going to need you to get in tune. I'm going to need you to put your boots on the ground and act like you care about black, brown, and indigenous bodies.
That's right.
Act like it's today with your kids.
I'm thinking to myself, I lost a child to police brutality. You can't wrap your brains around it, and yet you get to go home and wrap your arms around your child, and I don't.
Hey, you mentioned how, you know, this acting police chief said, essentially, I don't know what to do. I don't know what could have been done differently. In the last 24 hours, a lot has happened, I suppose. Like, the officer who shot Dante Wright was identified. She was placed on leave. Then she went ahead and resigned. The police chief, you mentioned, has resigned. The person above the police chief no longer oversees Brooklyn Center PD. I mean, in your mind, are there answers to that question? Like, what could be done right now that these folks haven't done?
The city manager was fired, but I feel like the chief of police and Kim Potter, a 26-year veteran on the force, should have been reined in and fired, too.
A resignation isn't good enough for you?
No, not at all, because all that does is give them the right to go to the next city and get hired. No, resignation is not good enough for me. They should be terminated, and she should be doing time.
Yeah, and the prosecutor, who's actually been given authority in this case, says he might have a charging decision by later today. In the meantime, what goes through your mind at, you know, during the nights here when you do see these acts of violence, of vandalism, of looting? I mean, what is your response to that?
Well, I think that, you know what, when society takes, the society must give. We're grown-ups, you know, real grown people here, and we are being forced into our homes at 7 o'clock, and every time that we decide, okay, this is it, boots on the ground, when you kill a person of color, then all of a sudden we're mad black men and women, We're having unpeaceful protests. We're doing this or we're doing that. But white terrorists can go to Washington and just seize the Capitol and yet live to tell the story. Had that been black men or women, it would have been a massacre, a blood pool.
Hey, last question. Have you spoken to the family of Dante Wright yet? I'm wondering what those sorts of conversations are like.
No, I haven't. But my plan is to speak to Mom, because I want to let her know that she is not alone and that I'm here. We're here.
Outside the courthouse, where former officer Derek Chauvin is standing trial, the Floyd family uniting with the Wright family, calling for change.
At some point, we need officers to be held accountable,
amen,
charged,
amen,
and convicted.
Amen.
Just because you are the law don't mean that you're above the law.
When you talk to mothers who have lost kids to law enforcement, and their kids have been gone 20 plus or more years, and they look at you and they just tell you the hardcore truth, it doesn't get any better. And I can honestly say, it's been 4 years for me, March 15th this year, they're right, it doesn't get any better. But I always speak to moms and let them know this. Yes, your son was killed, your daughter was killed, but they also lived at one time. So try to hold on to that and allow that to get you through.
And I think the anger and the hurt you're describing, that's part of the reason there's been so much frustration at, say, curfews, that even though there has been destruction, there has been violence in very isolated cases, that the breach of trust here was not because of the community. The breach of trust came from the police department. What everyone is acknowledging was an unjust death. We'll see how this plays out in the days to come. Kimberly Handy Jones, there in Minnesota right now. Thanks for your perspective. Thanks for sharing your story.
Yes, anytime. And thank you for taking the time to want to hear it.
Let's take a quick break. And when we come back, you thought fishing was a tough life? You'll never guess what these fishermen are facing. We're back in a bit.
The first ever criminal trial of a former president is underway in Manhattan. It's one of potentially four trials facing former President Trump as he makes his third bid for the White House. what do voters think about his culpability? And would a guilty verdict make a difference in the election? I'm Galen Druk, and every Monday and Thursday on the 538 Politics podcast, we break down the latest news from the campaign trail. We sort through the noise and zoom in on what really matters, using data and research as we go. That's 538 Politics every Monday and Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.
And one last thing. We talked earlier about how if there's doubt about the safety of something, it's really tough to convince people it's gonna be safe. So would you trust the government telling you, hey, we're gonna start dumping wastewater from a nuclear meltdown into the ocean?
We've judged that oceanic release is a realistic option.
That was the announcement yesterday in Japan, which has now approved a plan to take water from the Fukushima nuclear disaster and slowly pour it into the Pacific.
That massive 9.0 earthquake, the largest ever to rock Japan.
See, ever since the tsunami created the worst meltdown since Chernobyl, damaged nuclear reactors are still there and they still need to be kept cool. So every day, thousands of gallons are pumped through this plant. That radioactive wastewater then passes through a filtration system, but it's still toxic. It gets stored in big tanks. Well, now more than 1,000 tanks have piled up with no end in sight. So the plan now is to treat the water further and 2 years in the future start slowly funneling it into the Pacific.
The method Japan has chosen is both technically feasible and in line with international practice.
Japan has gotten all the necessary approvals on this. The International Atomic Energy Agency says this is the best plan. Oh, and by the way, other countries have done this and done it safely.
Even though the large amount of water makes it a unique and complex case.
The U.S. State Department says they trust Japan to do the right thing. But people in neighboring countries like China are not so sure, and neither are many Japanese people who make their livings offshore. The fishing industry there has suffered a lot over the last decade, in large part because since the disaster, a lot of people don't trust fish are healthy to eat. A trickle of wastewater now, however treated, is not going to help. I was already upset enough by the Cove. Now you got this controversy. Start here tomorrow. Just hit subscribe. Remember, ratings and reviews really, truly help us out. So if you haven't done one, get those thumbs moving. The defense has the case in the Derek Chauvin trial. You can stay up to the minute at abcnews.com or the ABC News app. I'm Brad Milkey. See you tomorrow.